How John Sulky exemplified those special attributes, the exact words which still echoed in John's mind, especially when he saw those undistinguished rows of C's and D's on his report card every term. Anyway, another sale. Chocolates. Double last year's price, but John was confident. Brother Leon had promised to put up a special honor roll on the bulletin board in the main first-floor corridor for those who had made their quota or exceeded it. A quota of 50 boxes, higher than ever before, which made John happy. It would be harder for the other guys to meet the quota. Already they were groaning and moaning, but John was supremely confident. In fact, when Brother Leon had told them about the special honor roll, John Sulky could have sworn he was looking directly at him, as if Brother Leon was counting personally on him to set a good example. So, let's see, the new housing development on Maple Terrace. Maybe he should make a special campaign in that neighborhood this year. There were 9 or 10 new homes there. But, first of all, the old faithfuls, the people who had become regular customers. Mrs. Swanson, who sometimes smelled of liquor but was always eager to buy anything, although she kept him talking too long, rambling on about people John Sulky didn't even know. And good old reliable Uncle Louie, who was always simonizing his car, although simonizing cars seemed part of the dark ages these days. And then the Capoletti's at the end of the street, who always invited him in for something to eat, cold pizza, that John wasn't exactly crazy about, and the smell of garlic that almost knocked you down. But you had to make sacrifices, big and small, for the sake of service to the school. Adamo? 4. Beauvais? 1. Brother Leon paused and looked up. Beauvais, you can do better than that. Only 1? Why, last year you set a record for the number of boxes sold in a week.
I'm a slow starter,
Beauvais said. He was a good-natured kid, not exactly a whiz in his studies, but likable, without an enemy in the world.
Check me next week, he said.
The class laughed, and the brother joined in the laughter. The goober laughed too, grateful for the small relaxation of tension. He found that in recent days the kids in class had a tendency to laugh at things that weren't really funny, simply because they seemed to be looking for something to divert them for a few moments, to prolong the roll call, prolong it until the R's were reached. Everyone knew what would happen when Renault's name came up. It was as if by laughing they could ignore the situation.
Fontaine?
10! A burst of applause led by Brother Leon himself.
Wonderful, Fontaine. True spirit. A wonderful display of spirit.
Goober found it hard to resist looking at Jerry. His friend sat stiff and tense, his knuckles white. This was the 4th day of the sale, and Jerry still called out no in the morning, staring straight ahead, rigid, determined. Forgetting his own troubles for a moment, Goober had tried approaching Jerry as they left the field after practice the day before. But Jerry pulled away.
Let me alone, Goob, he said. I know what you want to ask, but don't.
Parmentier?
6.
And then the gathering of tension. Jerry was next. Goober heard a weird sound, almost as if the class had sucked in its breath all at once.
Renault?
No.
Pause. You'd think Brother Leon would have gotten used to the situation by now, that he'd skip quickly over Renault's name. But each day the teacher's voice sang out with hope, and each day the negative response was given.
Santucci?
3.
The goober exhaled. So did the rest of the class. Strictly by accident, Goober happened to look up as Brother Leon marked down Santucci's report. He saw Leon's hand trembling. He had a terrible feeling of doom about to descend on all of them. The short, fat legs of Tubbs Casper carried him through the neighborhood in what for him was record time. He'd have made better time if one of his bicycle tires wasn't flat. Not only flat, but definitely beyond repair, and he didn't have money to buy a new tire. In fact, it was a desperate need for money that sent Tubbs scurrying around town like a madman from one house to another, lugging the chocolates, knocking at doors and ringing doorbells. He also had to do it furtively, afraid that his father or mother might see him. Small chance his father would come across him. He was at work at the plastic shop.
But his mother was another thing altogether. She was a nut about the car, like his father said, and couldn't bear to stay home and was always driving around. Tubbs's left arm began to ache from the weight of the chocolates, and he shifted his burden to his other arm, taking a moment to pat the reassuring bulge of his wallet. He had already sold 3 boxes, $6, but that wasn't enough, of course. He was still desperate. He needed a hell of a lot more by tonight, and nobody, but nobody, had bought any chocolates at the last 6 houses he'd visited. He had saved every cent he could from his allowance and had even sneaked a folded and greasy dollar bill from his father's pocket last night when he arrived home, half drunk and wobbly. He hated doing that, stealing from his own father. He vowed to return the money to him as soon as possible. When would that be? Tubbs didn't know. Money, money, money had become the constant need of his life. Money and his love for Rita. His allowance barely made it possible for him to take her to the movies and for a Coke afterward. $2.50 each for the movies, 50 cents for 2 Cokes. And his parents hated her for some reason. He had to sneak out to meet her. He had to make phone calls from Ossie Baker's house. "She's too old for you," his mother said, when actually Tubbs himself was 6 months older. "All right, she looks old," his mother said. What his mother should have said was, "She looks beautiful." She was so beautiful that she made Tubbs all shaky inside, like an earthquake going on. At night in bed, he could have one without even touching himself, just thinking of her. And now her birthday was tomorrow, and he had to buy her the present she wanted, the bracelet she'd seen in the window of Black's downtown, that terrible and beautiful bracelet, all sparkles and radiance, terrible because of the price tag. $18.95 plus tax. "Hun," she never called him Tubbs, "that's what I want most in all the world." Jesus, $18.95 plus the 3% sales tax, which Tubbs figured out would make a grand total of $19.52, the sales tax amounting to 57 cents. He knew that he didn't have to buy her the bracelet. She was a sweet girl who loved him for himself alone. She walked along the sidewalk with him, her breast brushing his arm, setting him on fire. The first time she rubbed against him, he thought it was an accident, and he pulled away, apologetic, leaving a space between them. Then she brushed against him again. That was the night he'd bought her the earrings. And he knew it wasn't an accident. He'd felt himself hardening and was suddenly ashamed and embarrassed and deliriously happy all at the same time. Him, Tubbs Casper, 40 pounds overweight, which his father never let him forget. Him, with this beautiful girl's breast pushed against him. Not beautiful the way his mother thought a girl was beautiful, but beautiful in a ripe, wild way. Faded blue jeans hugging her hips, those beautiful breasts bouncing under her jersey. She was only 14 and he was barely 15, but they were in love. Love, damn it, and it was only money that kept them apart. Money to take the bus to her house because she lived on the other side of town, and they'd made plans to meet tomorrow, her birthday, at Monument Park. A picnic, sort of. She'd bring the sandwiches and he'd bring the bracelet. He knew the delights that awaited him, but he also knew deep down inside that the bracelet was more important than anything else. All of which rushed him along now, out of breath and out of shape, trying to raise money that he knew dimly would lead him eventually only to trouble. Where would he raise enough money to pay it all back when the returns were due at school? But what the hell, he'd worry about it later. Right now, he needed to raise the money, and Rita loved him. Tomorrow, she'd probably let him get under her sweater. He rang the doorbell of a rich-looking house on Stearns Avenue and prepared his most innocent and sweetest smile for whoever opened the door. The woman's hair was damp and askew, and a little kid, maybe 2 or 3 years old, was tugging at her skirt. "Chocolates?" she asked, laughing bitterly, as if Paul Consalvo had suggested the most absurd thing in the world. "You want me to buy chocolates?" The baby, wearing a soggy-looking, droopy diaper, was calling, "Mommy!
Mommy!
And another kid was howling somewhere in the apartment. It's for a good cause, Paul said. Trinity School. Paul's nose wrinkled at the smell of pee. Jesus, the woman said. Chocolates!
Mommy! Mommy!
The kid squalled. Paul felt sorry for older people, stuck in their houses and tenements with kids to take care of and housework to do. He thought of his own parents and their useless lives, his father collapsing into his nap every night after supper, and his mother looking tired and dragged out all the time. What the hell were they living for? He couldn't wait to get out of the house. "Where are you going all the time?" his mother asked as he fled the place. How could he tell her that he hated the house, that his mother and father were dead and didn't know it, that if it wasn't for television, the place would be like a tomb? He couldn't say that because he really loved them. And if the house caught fire in the middle of the night, he'd rescue them. He'd be willing to sacrifice his own life for them. But geez, it was so boring, so deadly at home. What did they have to live for? They were too old for sex, even. Although Paul turned away from the thought, he couldn't believe that his mother and father ever actually... Sorry, the woman said, shutting the door in his face, still shaking her head in wonder at his sales pitch. Paul stood in the doorway, wondering what to do. He'd had rotten luck this afternoon, hadn't sold a single box. He hated selling them anyway, although it gave him an excuse to get out of the house. But he couldn't really put his heart in it. He was just going through the motions. Outside the apartment house, Paul considered his choices, pressing on with the sale despite his luck today, or going home. He crossed the street and rang the doorbell of another apartment building. In an apartment house, you could knock off 5 or 6 families at one time, even though the places all seemed to smell of pee. Brother Leon had volunteered Brian Cochran for the position of treasurer of the chocolate sale, which meant that he'd looked around the classroom, pinned those watery eyes on Brian, pointed his finger, and voila, as Brother Aimé said in French class, Brian was treasurer. He hated the job because he lived in fear of Brother Leon. You never knew about Leon. Brian was a senior, and he'd had Leon as either a classroom teacher or as homeroom supervisor for 4 years, and he was still uncomfortable in his presence. The teacher was unpredictable, and yet predictable at the same time, which reasoning confused Brian because he wasn't exactly a hotshot in the psychology department. It was this. You knew that Leon would always do the unexpected. Wasn't that being both predictable and unpredictable? He loved to toss surprise exams at a class, and he also could suddenly be the nice guy, not giving a test for weeks, or giving a test and then throwing away the results, or concocting a pass-fail test, he was famous for that type, where he threaded together questions that could throw a guy for a loss with what seemed like a million possible answers. He was also quite a man with a pointer, although he usually confined that kind of stuff to freshmen. If he ever pulled the pointer antics with, say, somebody like Carter, there'd be hell to pay. But not everybody was John Carter, president of the Vigils, all-star guard on the football team and president of the boxing club. How Brian Cochran would love to be like John Carter, with muscles instead of glasses, quick with boxing gloves instead of figures. Speaking of figures, Brian Cochran began double-checking the sales totals. As usual, there was a discrepancy between the amount of chocolates reported as sold and the actual money received. The guys were notorious for holding back some of the money until the last minute. Ordinarily, nobody got excited about it. It was human nature. A lot of the guys sold chocolates, spent the money on a big date or a big night, and then put in the money when they got their allowance or their pay at their part-time jobs. But this year, Brother Leon acted as if every dollar was a matter of life and death. In fact, he was driving Brian Cochran up a wall. The job of treasurer called for Brian to check every homeroom at the end of the day and write down the returns the boys had reported, how many boxes sold, how much money turned in. Brian then went to Brother Leon's office and totaled all the figures. Then Brother Leon would come along and check Brian's report. Simple, right? Wrong. The way Brother Leon was carrying on this year made every day's report seem like a major headline event. Brian had never seen the brother so edgy, so nervous. At first, he'd gotten a kick out of the teacher's apprehension, the way the sweat poured off him like he had a special pump inside producing all that perspiration. When he came into the office and took off the black suit coat he was required to wear in the classroom during all seasons, sweat stains darkened his armpits, and he smelled as if he'd just gone 10 rounds in the ring. He fidgeted and fussed around, double-checking Brian's figures, chewing on a pencil, pacing the floor. Today, Brian was more puzzled than ever. Leon had passed around a report to all the homerooms listing total sales thus far at 4,582, which was wrong. The kids had sold exactly 3,961 boxes and had made returns on 2,871. Sales were definitely lagging behind last year, and so was the money. He couldn't understand why Leon had issued a false report. Did he think he could hype them up that way? Brian shrugged, tabulating his own totals once more to be sure that Brother Leon wouldn't blame him for any discrepancies. He'd hate to have Leon for an enemy, which is one reason he'd accepted the job of treasurer without making waves. Brian was a member of Leon's algebra class, and he didn't want to take any chances with extra homework or sudden unexplained Fs on exams. Looking at the summary once again, Brian saw the zero next to the name of Jerome Renault. He chuckled. That was the freshman who refused to sell any chocolates. Brian shook his head. Who'd want to buck the system? Hell, who'd want to buck Brother Leon? The kid must be some kind of madman.
LeBlanc, 6. Mallorin, 3.
The pause, the intake of breath. It had gotten to be a game now, this roll call, this fascinating moment in Brother Leon's homeroom. Even Goober couldn't help but get caught up in the tension, although the entire situation made him slightly sick to his stomach. Goober was a peaceful figure. He hated strain, contention. Peace, let's have peace. But there was no peace in Brother Leon's room in the morning as he called the roll of chocolate sales. He stood tense at the desk, those watery eyes blinking in the morning light, while Jerry Renault sat, as usual, at his desk without emotion, frigid, elbows resting on the surface of the desk.
Parmentier, 2.
Now.
Renault,
inhale. No, exhale. The color spreading on Leon's face, like his veins had turned into scarlet neon signs.
Santucci?
2.
The goober couldn't wait for the bell to ring. 15.
Hey, Archie, Emil Janza called.
Yes, Emil?
You still got the picture?
What picture? Suppressing a smile.
You know what picture.
Oh, that picture. Yes, Emil, I still have it.
I don't suppose it's for sale, Archie.
Not for sale, Emil. What would you want with that picture anyway?
To tell you the truth, Emil, it's not the greatest picture ever taken of you. I mean, you're not even smiling or anything. There's this funny look on your face, but you're not smiling, Emil.
There was a funny look on Emil Janza's face right at this moment, and he wasn't smiling now either. Anyone else but Archie would have been intimidated by that look.
Where do you keep the picture, Archie?
It's safe, Emil, very safe.
That's good.
Archie wondered, should I tell him the truth about the picture? He knew that Emil Janza could be a dangerous enemy. On the other hand, the photograph also could be used as a weapon.
Tell you what, Emil, Archie said, someday you might be able to get the photograph all for yourself.
Janza flipped his cigarette against a tree and watched the butt ricochet into the gutter. He withdrew a package from his pocket, discovered it was empty, and tossed it away, watching the breeze move it along on the sidewalk. Emil Janza didn't care about keeping America beautiful.
How can I get the photograph, Archie?
Well, you won't have to buy it, Emil.
You mean you'd give it to me?
There must be a catch, Archie.
There is, Emil. But nothing you can't handle when the time comes.
You let me know when the time comes, okay, Archie?
Emil asked, giggling his foolish giggle. You'll be the first to know, Archie said.
The tone of their conversation had been light, bantering, but Archie knew that Emil was deadly serious underneath. Archie also knew that Janza would be willing to practically murder him in his sleep to get his hot hands on the picture. And the terrible irony, there was no picture after all. Archie had merely taken advantage of a ridiculous situation. What happened was this. Archie had cut a class and glided through the corridor, evading the brothers. Moving past an open locker, he'd spotted a camera dangling from one of the coat hooks. Automatically, Archie had taken the camera. He wasn't a thief, of course. He figured he'd merely abandon it somewhere so that the owner, whoever he was, would have to chase around the school looking for it. Stepping into the men's room to grab a quick smoke, Archie had pulled open the door to one of the stalls and confronted Janza, sitting there, pants dropping on the floor, one hand furiously at work between his legs. Archie lifted the camera and pretended to take a picture, yelling, "Hold it!"
"Beautiful," Archie had called.
Janza had been too shocked and surprised to react quickly. By the time he had recovered, Archie was at the doorway, poised to flee if Janza made a move.
"Better hand over that camera," Janza called.
"If you're going to jack off in a toilet, at least lock your door," Archie taunted.
"The lock's broken," Emil replied. "All the locks are broken."
"Well, don't worry, Emil. Your secret is safe with me." Now Janza turned from Archie and spotted a freshman hurrying across the street, evidently worried because he was afraid of being late for classes. It took a year or two to develop the timing that allowed you to linger until the last possible moment at the doorway.
"Hey, freshman," Janza called.
The kid looked up, panic-stricken, when he saw Janza.
"Afraid you're going to be late?"
The kid gulped, nodding his head.
"Have no fear, freshman."
The final whistle blew, exactly 45 seconds to make it to homerooms.
"I'm all out of cigarettes," Emil declared, patting his pockets.
Archie smiled, knowing what Janza planned. Janza considered himself a candidate for the vigils, and he was always trying to impress Archie.
"What I'd like, kid, is for you to run over to Baker's and buy me a pack of cigarettes."
"I haven't got any money," the boy protested, "and I'll be late for school."
"That's life, kid. That's the way it goes. Heads I win, tails you lose. If you haven't got the money, steal the smokes. Or borrow the money. Just meet me at lunch with the cigarettes. Any brand, Emil Janza's not fussy."
Tossing in his name so that the kid would know who he was dealing with in the event he hadn't been tipped off about Emil Janza. Archie lingered, knowing he was flirting with a tardy rap. But he was fascinated by Janza, crude and gross as he was. The world was made up of two kinds of people, those who were victims and those who victimized. There was no doubt about Janza's category, no doubt about himself either, and no doubt about the kid taking off down the hill, tears spilling onto his cheeks as he turned away.
"He's got the money, Archie," Emil said. "Don't you figure he's got the money and was lying through his teeth?"
"I'll bet you also kick old ladies down the stairs and trip cripples on the street," Archie said. Janza giggled. The giggle chilled Archie, who himself was considered capable of hurting little old ladies and tripping cripples. 16.
"Such a terrible mark, Caroni."
"I know, I know.
And you are usually such a splendid scholar."
"Thank you, Brother Leon.
How are your other marks?"
"Fine, brother, fine. In fact, I was aiming for high honors this term, but now this F."
"I know," the teacher said, shaking his head sorrowfully, in commiseration.
Caroni was confused. He had never received an F before in his life. In fact, he had seldom received a mark lower than an A. In the 7th and 8th grades at St. Jude's, he had received straight A's for 2 years, except for a B-plus one term. He had scored so high on the Trinity entrance exam that he had been awarded one of the rare Trinity scholarships, $100 contributed toward his tuition and his picture in the paper. And then this terrible F, a routine test turning into a nightmare.
"The F surprised me as well," Brother Leon said, "because you are such an excellent student, David."
Caroni looked up in sudden wonder and hope. Brother Leon seldom called a student by his first name. He always kept a distance between himself and his pupils. "There is an invisible line between teacher and student," he always said, "and it must not be crossed." But now, hearing him pronounce David in such friendly fashion and with such gentleness and understanding, Caroni allowed himself to hope. But for what? Had the F been a mistake after all? "This was a difficult test for several reasons," the teacher went on. "One of those exams where the wrong, subtle interpretation of the facts made the difference between pass and fail. In fact, that was it exactly, a pass-fail test. And when I read your answer, David, for a moment I thought it was possible that you had passed. In many respects, you were correct in your assertions. But, on the other hand," his voice trailed away. He seemed deep in thought, troubled. Caroni waited. A horn blew outside, the school bus lumbering away. He thought of his father and mother and what they would do when they learned of the F. It would drag down his average. It was almost impossible to overcome an F, no matter how many other A's he managed to make. "One thing students don't always realize, David," Brother Leon went on, speaking softly, intimately, as if there were no one in the world except them, as if he had never talked to anyone in the world the way he was talking to David at this moment. "One thing they don't grasp is that teachers are human, too. Human, like other people." Brother Leon smiled as if he had made a joke. Caroni allowed himself a small smile, unsure of himself, not wanting to do the wrong thing. The classroom was suddenly warm. It seemed crowded, although there were just the two of them there. "Yes. Yes, we are all too human. We have our good days and our bad days. We get tired. Our judgment sometimes becomes impaired. We sometimes, as the boys say, goof. It's possible, even for us, to make mistakes correcting papers, especially when the answers are not cut and dried. Not one thing or another, not all black nor all white." Caroni was all ears now, alert. What was Brother Leon driving at? He looked sharply at Brother Leon. The teacher looked as he always did, the moist eyes that reminded Caroni of boiled onions, the pale, damp skin and the cool talk always under control. He held a piece of white chalk in his hand, like a cigarette, or maybe like a miniature pointer. "Did you ever hear a teacher admit that it's possible for him to make a mistake, David? Ever hear that before?" Brother Leon asked, laughing. "Like an umpire saying he made the wrong call," Caroni said, joining in the teacher's little joke. "But why the joke? Why all this talk of mistakes?" "Yes, yes," Leon agreed. "No one is without error. And it's understandable. We all have our duties and we must discharge them. The headmaster is still in the hospital and I take it as a privilege to act in his behalf. Besides this, there are the extracurricular activities, the chocolate sale, for instance." Brother Leon's grip was tight on the piece of chalk. Caroni noticed how his knuckles were almost as white as the chalk itself. He waited for the teacher to continue, but there was only silence. Caroni watched the chalk in Brother Leon's hands, the way the teacher pressed it, rolled it, his fingers like the legs of pale spiders with a victim in their clutch. "But it's all rewarding," Leon went on. How was it that his voice was so cool when the hand holding the chalk was so tense, the veins sticking out as if threatening to burst through the flesh? "Rewarding?" Caroni had lost the thread of Brother Leon's thought. "The chocolate sale," Leon said, and the chalk split in his hand. "For instance," Leon said, dropping the pieces and opening the ledger that was so familiar to everyone at Trinity, the ledger in which the daily sales were recorded. "Let me see. You've done fine in the sale, David. 18 boxes sold. Fine, fine. Not only are you an excellent scholar, but you possess school spirit." Caroni blushed with pleasure. It was impossible for him to resist a compliment, even when he was all mixed up, as he certainly was at the moment. All this talk of exams and teachers getting tired and making mistakes, and now the chocolate sale, and the two pieces of broken chalk abandoned on the desk like white bones, dead men's bones. If everyone did his part like you, David, the sale would be an instant success. Of course, not everyone has your spirit, David. Caroni wasn't sure what tipped him off. Maybe the way Brother Leon paused at this point. Maybe the entire conversation, all of it off-key somehow. Or maybe the chalk in Brother Leon's hands, the way he had snapped it in two while his voice remained cool and easy. Which was the phony thing? The hand holding the chalk, all tense and nervous, or the cool, easy voice? Take Renault, for instance, Brother Leon continued. Funny thing about him, isn't it? And Caroni knew. He found himself staring into the moist, watchful eyes of the teacher, and in a blinding flash he knew what this was all about, what was happening, what Brother Leon was doing, the reason for this little conversation after school. A headache began to assert itself above his right eye, the pain digging into his flesh, migraine. His stomach lurched sickeningly. Were teachers like everyone else, then? Were teachers as corrupt as the villains you read about in books or saw in movies and television? He'd always worshipped his teachers, had thought of becoming a teacher himself someday if he could overcome his shyness. But now, this. The pain grew in intensity, throbbing in his forehead. "Actually, I feel badly for Renault," Brother Leon was saying. "He must be a very troubled boy to act this way." "I guess so," Caroni said, stalling, uncertain of himself, and yet knowing really what Brother Leon wanted. He had seen Brother Leon every day in the classroom calling out the names and had watched him recoil as if from a blow when Jerry Renault continued to refuse the chocolates. It had become a kind of joke among the fellows. Actually, Caroni had felt badly for Jerry Renault. He knew that no kid was a match for Brother Leon. But now he realized that Brother Leon had been the victim. He must have been climbing the walls all this time, David thought. "Well, David?" And the echo of his name here in the classroom startled him. He wondered if he still had aspirins left in his locker. Forget the aspirins. Forget the headache. He knew now what the score was, what Leon was waiting to hear. Yet could he be sure? "Speaking of Jerry Renault," Caroni said, a safe beginning, a statement he could draw back from, depending on Brother Leon's reaction. "Yes?" The hand had picked up one of the pieces of chalk again, and that yes had been too quick, too sudden to allow any doubt. Caroni found himself hung up between choices, and the headache didn't help matters. Could he erase that F by telling Brother Leon simply what he wanted to hear? What was so terrible about that? On the other hand, an F could ruin him. And how about all the other Fs it was possible that Leon could give him in the future? "Funny thing about Jerry Renault," Caroni heard himself saying, and then instinct caused him to add, "but I'm sure you know what it's all about, Brother Leon. The vigils, the assignment." of course," Leon said, sitting back, letting the chalk fall gently from his hand. "It's a vigil stunt. He's supposed to refuse to sell chocolates for 10 days, 10 school days, and then accept them. Boy, those vigils, they're really something, aren't they?" His head was killing him, and his stomach was a sea of nausea. "Boys will be boys," Leon was saying, nodding his head, his voice a whisper. It was hard to tell whether he was surprised or relieved. Knowing Trinity's spirit, it was obvious, of course. Poor Renault. "You remember, Caroni, that I said he must be troubled? Terrible to force a boy into that kind of situation, against his will. But it's all over then, isn't it? The 10 days, why, they're up, let's see, tomorrow." He was smiling now, gaily, and talking as if the words themselves didn't matter, but that it was important to talk, as if the words were safety valves. And then Caroni realized that Brother Leon had used his name, but this time he hadn't said David. "Well, I guess that's it then," Brother Leon said, rising. "I've detained you too long, Caroni." "Brother Leon," Caroni said, He couldn't be dismissed at this point. You said you wanted to discuss my mark.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right, my boy, that F of yours.
Caroni felt doom pressing upon him, but went on anyway. You said teachers make mistakes. They get tired. Brother Leon was standing now.
Tell you what, Caroni. At the end of the term, when the marks close, I'll review that particular test. Perhaps I'll be fresher then. Perhaps I'll see merit that wasn't apparent before.
Now it was Caroni's turn to feel relief from the tension, although his headache still pounded and his stomach was still upset. Worse than that, however, he had allowed Brother Leon to blackmail him. If teachers did this kind of thing, what kind of world could it be?
On the other hand, Caroni, perhaps the F will stand, Brother Leon said.
It depends. I see, Brother Leon, Caroni said. And he did see that life was rotten, that there were no heroes really, and that you couldn't trust anybody, not even yourself. He had to get out of there as fast as possible before he vomited all over Brother Leon's desk. 17.
Adamo?
3.
Beauvais?
5.
The goober was impatient for the roll call to be over, or rather, for the roll call to reach Jerry Renault. Like everyone else, the goober had finally learned that Jerry was carrying out a vigil assignment. That's why he had refused to take the chocolates day after day. That's why he didn't want to talk about it with Goober. Now Jerry could become himself again, human again. His football had suffered.
What the hell's the matter with you, Renault? The coach asked in disgust yesterday. Do you want to play ball or not?
And Jerry had answered, I'm playing ball. All the kids knew the double meaning his answer conveyed because it was public knowledge now. He and Goober had had only one brief conversation about the assignment. In fact, it wasn't really a conversation. Leaving football practice yesterday, Goober had whispered, When does the assignment end? And Jerry had said, Tomorrow I take the chocolates.
Hartnett?
1.
You can do better than that, Hartnett, Leon said, but there was no anger, not even disappointment in his voice.
Brother Leon was buoyant today, and his mood had spread throughout the class. That's the way Leon's classes were. He set the mood and the temperature. When Brother Leon was happy, everybody was happy. When he was miserable, everybody was miserable.
Johnson?
5.
Good, good.
Kalea, LeBlanc, Malloran, the roll call went on, the voices shouting out their sales, and the teacher checking the names off on the sheet. The names and the responses sounded almost like a song, a melody for a classroom, a tune for many voices. Then Brother Leon called out,
Parmentier!
And there was tension in the air. Parmentier could have called out any number and it wouldn't have mattered, it wouldn't have created any impact at all, because the next name was Renault.
3,
Parmentier called out.
Right,
Brother Leon answered, making the check against the name. Looking up, he called,
Renault?
The pause, the damn pause.
No!
The goober felt as if his eyes were the lens for a television camera in one of those documentaries. He swung around in Jerry's direction and saw his friend's face, white, mouth half open, his arms dangling at his sides. And then he swiveled to look at Brother Leon and saw the shock on the teacher's face, his mouth forming an oval of astonishment. It seemed almost as if Jerry and the teacher were reflections in a mirror. Finally, Brother Leon looked down.
Renault!
He said again, his voice like a whip.
No, I'm not going to sell the chocolates.
Cities fell, earth opened, planets tilted, stars plummeted, and the awful silence.
18.
Why did you do it? I don't know. Have you gone crazy? Maybe I have. It was a crazy thing to do. I know. The way that no popped out of your mouth. Why? I don't know. It was like the third degree, only he was both interrogator and suspect, both tough cop and hounded prisoner, a cruel spotlight pinning him in a blinding circle of light. All of this in his mind, of course, as he tossed in his bed, the sheet twisted around him like a shroud, suffocatingly. He fought the sheet, filled suddenly with the terror of claustrophobia, being buried alive. Aware of his mortality, he turned over again and tangled in the bedclothes. His pillow fell off the bed, hitting the floor with a dull thud, like a small body landing there. He thought of his mother dead in the coffin. When did death arrive? He had read a magazine article about heart transplants. Even the doctors couldn't agree on the exact moment that death occurred. Listen, he told himself, no one can be buried alive these days, not like in the olden times when there was no embalming fluid and stuff. Now they removed all your blood and pumped in chemicals and stuff to make certain you were dead. But suppose, let's just suppose that some small spark in your brain remained alive and knew what was going on. His mother. Himself someday. He leaped from the bed in terror, flinging the sheet away. His body was moist, oozing perspiration. He sat on the edge of the bed, trembling. Then his feet touched the floor in the cool kiss of the linoleum established reality. The specter of suffocation vanished. He made his way through the darkness to the window and pulled back the drape. The wind came up, scattering October leaves, which fluttered to the ground like doomed and crippled birds.
Why did you do it?
I don't know. Like a broken record. Was it because of what Brother Leon does to people like Bailey, the way he tortures them, tries to make fools of them in front of everybody? More than that. More than that.
Then what?
He allowed the drape to fall back into place and surveyed the bedroom, squinting into the half-darkness. He padded over to the bed, shivering in the kind of coolness that can only be found in the middle of the night. He listened for night sounds. His father snored in the next room. A car gunned along the street outside. He'd love to be gunning along the street, going someplace, anywhere. I'm not going to sell the chocolates, boy. He hadn't planned to do any such thing, of course. He'd been happy to have the terrible assignment all over with, the assignment completed and life normal once again. Every morning he dreaded the roll call, the necessity of facing Brother Leon, saying no, and watching Leon's reaction, how the teacher tried to pass off Jerry's rebellion as if it didn't matter, putting on a pathetic pretense of indifference, but a pretense that was so transparent, so phony. It had been funny and terrible at the same time, watching Leon call the roll and waiting for his name to be called, and finally his name blazing in the air and a defiant no. The teacher might have been able to carry off his act successfully, except for his eyes. His eyes gave him away. His face was always under control, but his eyes showed his vulnerability, gave Jerry a glimpse into the hell that was burning inside the teacher. Those moist eyes, the white eyeballs and the diluted blue of his pupils, eyes that reflected everything that went on in the class, reacting to everything. After Jerry had learned that the secret of Brother Leon lurked in his eyes, he became watchful, seeing the way the eyes betrayed the teacher at every turn. And then there came a time when Jerry was tired of it all, tired of watching the teacher, disgusted with the contest of wills that wasn't really a contest because Jerry had no choice. Cruelty sickened Jerry. And the assignment, he realized after a few days, was cruel. Even though Archie Costello had insisted that it was only a stunt that everyone would get a kick out of later. And so he had finally waited, impatient for the assignment to come to an end, eager for that silent battle between Brother Leon and himself to be over with. He wanted life to be normal again, football, even his homework, without that daily burden weighing him down. He had felt isolated from the other fellows, separated by the secret he was forced to carry. He'd been tempted once or twice to talk it over with the goober. In fact, he'd almost done so once when Goob tried to start a conversation. Instead, he'd cautioned himself to hold on for the 2 weeks, to carry it off, secrecy and all, and be done with it for good. He had met Brother Leon in the corridor late one afternoon after football practice and had seen hate flashing in the teacher's eyes. More than hate. Something sick. Jerry had felt soiled, dirty, as if he should run to confession and bare his soul. And he'd consoled himself. When I accept the chocolates and Brother Leon realizes I was only carrying out a vigil assignment, then everything will be fine again. Then why had he called no this morning? He'd wanted to end the ordeal, and then that terrible no had issued from his mouth. In bed once more, Jerry lay without moving, trying to summon sleep. Listening to his father's snores, he thought of how his father was actually sleeping his life away, sleeping even when he was awake, not really alive. And how about me? What was it the guy on the common had said the other day, his chin resting on the Volkswagen like some grotesque John the Baptist? You're missing a lot of things in the world. He turned over, dismissing his doubts, and calling to mind the figure of a girl he'd seen downtown the other day. Her sweater had bulged beautifully, her schoolbooks pressed against her rounded breasts. If my hands were only those books, he'd thought longingly. His hand now curled between his legs. He concentrated on the girl. But for once it was no good. No good. 19. The next morning, Jerry found out how a hangover must feel. His eyes burned with fire, fueled by lack of sleep. His head throbbed with shooting pains. His stomach was sensitive to the slightest movement, and the lurching of the bus caused strange reactions in his body. It reminded him of when he was a kid and got car sick sometimes on trips to the beach with his parents so that they'd have to stop the car by the side of the road while Jerry either vomited or waited for the storm in his stomach to subside. What added to his troubles this morning was the possibility of a test in geography, and he hadn't studied at all last night, so wrapped up had he been in the chocolate sale and what had happened in Leon's class. Now he was paying the penalty for too little sleep and no study, trying to read a lousy geography lesson on a lumbering, lurching bus, the morning light dazzling on the white page. Somebody slipped into the seat beside him. "Hey, Renault. You got guts, know that?" Jerry looked up, blinded momentarily as his eyes shifted from the page to the face of the kid who'd spoken to him. He knew him vaguely from school, a junior, maybe. Lighting a cigarette the way all the smokers did, despite the no-smoking signs, the kid shook his head. "Boy, you really let Leon, that bastard, have it." "Beautiful." He blew out smoke. Jerry's eyes stung. "Oh," he said, feeling stupid and surprised. Funny. All this time he had thought of the situation as a private battle between Brother Leon and himself, as if the two of them were alone on the planet. Now he realized that it had gone beyond that. "I'm so sick of selling the frigging chocolates," the kid said. He had a terrible case of acne, his face like a relief map, and his fingers were stained with nicotine. "I've been at Trinity 2 years. I transferred from Monument High when I was a freshman. And Christ, I'm getting tired of selling stuff." He tried to blow a smoke ring, but failed. Worse than that, the smoke blew back in Jerry's face, stinging his eyes. "If it isn't chocolates, it's Christmas cards. If it isn't Christmas cards, it's soap. If it isn't soap, it's calendars. But you know what?" "What?" Jerry asked, wanting to get back to his geography. "I never thought of just saying no, like you did." "I've got some studying to do," Jerry said, not knowing what to say, really. "Boy, you're cool, know that?" the kid said admiringly. Jerry blushed with pleasure, despite himself, who didn't want to be admired. And yet he felt guilty, knowing that he was accepting the kid's admiration under false pretenses, that he wasn't cool at all, not at all. His head pounded and his stomach moved menacingly, and he realized he had to face Brother Leon and the roll call again this morning. And all the mornings to come. The goober was waiting for him at the school's entrance, standing tense and troubled among the other fellows waiting for school to start, like prisoners resigned to execution, taking their final drags from cigarettes before the bells began to ring. The goober motioned Jerry aside. Jerry followed him guiltily. He realized that Goober wasn't the cheerful, happy-go-lucky kid he'd known when school first started. What had happened? He'd been so wrapped up in his own concerns that he hadn't bothered about Goob.
"Geez, Jerry, what did you do it for?" Goober asked, drawing him away from the others.
"Do what?" But he knew what Goober meant.
"The chocolates!"
"I don't know, Goob," Jerry said. It was no use faking out Goober the way he had faked out that kid on the bus.
"That's the truth. I don't know." "You're asking for trouble, Jerry. Brother Leon spells trouble."
"Look, Goob," Jerry said, wanting to reassure his friend, wanting to wipe that look of concern from his face. "It's not the end of the world. 400 kids in this school are going to sell chocolates. What does it matter if I don't?"
"It's not that simple, Jerry. Brother Leon won't let you get away with it."
The warning bell sounded. Cigarettes were flipped into the gutter or mashed into the sand-filled receptacle near the door. Last drags were inhaled lingeringly. Guys who'd been sitting in cars listening to rock on the radio switched them off and slammed the doors behind them. "Nice going, kid," somebody said, hurrying by. The pat on the ass, Trinity's traditional gesture of friendship. Jerry didn't see who it was.
"Keep it up, Jerry,"
this a corner-of-the-mouth whisper from Adamo, who hated Leon with a vengeance.
"See how the word is spreading?" Goober hissed. "What's more important, football and your marks or the lousy chocolate sale?"
The bell rang again. It meant 2 minutes left to get to your locker and then to your homeroom. A senior by the name of Benson approached them. Seniors were trouble for freshmen. It was better to be ignored by them than to be noticed. But Benson was clearly headed in their direction. He was a nut, known for his lack of inhibitions, his complete disregard of the rules. As he neared Jerry and Goober, he began a Jimmy Cagney imitation, shooting his cuffs and hunching his shoulders.
"Hey there, guy. I wouldn't be in your shoes. I wouldn't be in your shoes for a thou, boy, a mill."
He punched Jerry playfully on the arm.
"You couldn't fit those shoes anyway, Benson," somebody yelled, and Benson danced away. Sammy Davis now, wide grin, feet tapping, body whirling.
Walking up the stairs, Goober said,
"Do me a favor, Jerry. Take the chocolates today."
"I can't, Goob."
"Why not?"
"I just can't. I'm committed now."
"The goddamn vigils,"
Goober said. Jerry had never heard Goober swear before. He'd always been a mild kind of kid, rolling with the punches, loose and carefree, running around the track while the other kids sat up tight during practice sessions.
"It's not the vigils, Goob. They're not in it anymore. It's me."
They stopped at Jerry's locker.
"All right,"
Goober said, resigned, knowing it was useless to pursue the subject any further at the moment. Jerry felt sad suddenly because Goober looked so troubled, like an old man heaped with all the sorrows of the world, his thin face drawn and haggard, his eyes haunted, as if he had awakened from a nightmare he couldn't forget. Jerry opened his locker. He had thumbtacked a poster to the back wall of his locker on the first day of school. The poster showed a wide expanse of beach, a sweep of sky with a lone star glittering far away. A man walked on the beach, a small, solitary figure in all that immensity. At the bottom of the poster, these words appeared: "Do I dare disturb the universe?" By Eliot, who wrote the wasteland thing they were studying in English. Jerry wasn't sure of the poster's meaning, but it had moved him mysteriously. It was traditional at Trinity for everyone to decorate the interior of his locker with a poster. Jerry chose this one. He had no time now to ponder the poster any longer. The final bell rang, and he had 30 seconds to get to class.
Adamo, 2. Beauvais, 3.
It was a different roll call this morning, a new melody, a new tempo, as if Brother Leon were the conductor and the class the members of a verbal orchestra. But something wrong with the beat, something wrong with the entire proceedings, as if the members of the orchestra were controlling the pace and not the conductor. No sooner would Brother Leon call out a name than the response came immediately, before Leon had time to make a notation in the ledger. It was the kind of spontaneous game that developed in classes without premeditation, everyone falling into a sudden conspiracy. The quickness of the responses kept Brother Leon busy at his desk, head bent, pencil furiously scribbling. Jerry was glad he wouldn't have to look into those watery eyes.
LeBlanc, 1. Malorin, 2.
Names and numbers sizzled in the air, and Jerry began to notice something curious about it.
All the ones and twos and an occasional three, but no fives, no tens. And Brother Leon's head still bent, concentrating on the ledger. And finally, Renault. It would be so easy, really, to yell yes, to say, give me the chocolates to sell, Brother Leon. So easy to be like the others, not to have to confront those terrible eyes every morning. Brother Leon finally looked up. The tempo of the roll call had broken. No, Jerry said. He was swept with sadness. A sadness deep and penetrating, leaving him desolate like someone washed up on a beach, a lone survivor in a world full of strangers. 20. At this period of history, man began to learn more about his environment. Suddenly, pandemonium reigned. The class exploded in frantic motion. Brother Jacques looked aghast. The boys leaped from their chairs, performed an insane jig, jumping up and down as if to the beat of unheard music, all of this in complete silence, although the sound of their jogging feet was noisy enough, and then sat down again, frozen-faced, as if nothing had happened. Obi watched the teacher sourly. Brother Jacques was obviously bewildered. Bewildered? Hell, he was on the edge of panic. The ritual had been going on for a week now, and it would continue until the cue was heard no more. In the meantime, the class would suddenly erupt into a confusion of waving arms and jogging legs, unsettling poor brother. Of course, Brother Jacques was easy to unsettle. He was new and young and sensitive, raw meat for Archie. And he evidently didn't know what to do about it, and so he didn't do anything, figuring, apparently, that the thing would run its course, and why risk a futile showdown when it was obviously a prank? What else could it be? Funny, Obi thought, how everybody, the kids as well as the teachers, knew these stunts were planned or carried out by the vigils, and yet they still maintained that air of mystery, refusing to acknowledge it all. He wondered why. Obi had been involved in so many vigil assignments that he'd lost count of them, and he was continually amazed at how they got away with it all the time. In fact, he'd been getting tired of the assignments, of playing nursemaid for Archie, and his trigger man as well. He was tired of being the fixer, making certain the assignment went off on schedule in order to maintain Archie's big-shot reputation. Like the Room 19 assignment, when he'd had to creep in there and help the kid Goober take the place apart. All that work so that Archie and the vigils would look good. Even this particular assignment involved him. If Brother Jacques failed to come up with the cue, then Obi had to find a way to feed it to him. The cue was the word environment. As Archie had said when he announced the assignment, the world today is concerned with ecology, the environment, our natural resources. We at Trinity also ought to get involved in this environment thing. You guys, he said, indicating the 14 students of grade 12, class 2, of whom Obi was a member, will carry on our environmental campaign. Let's say Brother Jacques' U.S. history class. History should be concerned with environment, shouldn't it? Now, whenever Brother Jacques says the word environment, here's what happens. And Archie had outlined the instructions. Suppose he doesn't use the word, someone asked. Archie looked toward Obi. Oh, Brother Jacques will use the word. I'm sure somebody, Obi maybe, will ask a question that will produce the word. Won't you, Obi? Obi had nodded, disguising his disgust. What the hell was Archie involving him in an assignment at this stage of the game for? He was a senior, for crying out loud. He was secretary of the goddamn vigils, for crying out loud. Jesus, how he hated Archie, that bastard! A new kid, a transfer from Monument High, asked, what happens when Brother Jacques finds out we're putting him on? When he finds out that the key word is environment? Then he stops using it, Archie said, which is the point of the whole damn thing. I'm getting sick and tired of all this environment crap. And at least we'll have one teacher in the frigging school who'll cross it off his vocabulary list. For his part, Obi was getting sick and tired of Archie, of picking up the pieces behind him, of performing those little services like Room 19 or cueing in Brother Jacques, feeding him a question that could only lead to the word environment in the answer. Anyway, he was getting fed up with the entire deal. And he was also biding his time, waiting for Archie to overreach himself, to make a mistake.
The black box was always there, and who could tell when Archie's luck would run out? In any discussion of the environment, here we go again, Obi thought.